Welcome to The Mentor Files. I'm your host, Monica Royer, founder of Monica and Andy. If I've learned anything about running a business, it's that I've got so much left to learn. Join me as I chat with some of the world's most inspiring CEOs, passionate entrepreneurs, and experts at the top of their field to bring you invaluable insider advice and candid conversation about their journey to success. Here we go.
As a former professional soccer star, Tim Brown was used to trying out and receiving tons of free shoes, especially from his sponsors. It was then that he started to notice a trend. All sports shoes were starting to look a bit the same. Growing up in New Zealand, he was familiar with all the great qualities of wool and started testing out what a shoe would look like with that material. He learned that wool was perfect for minimizing odor and regulating temperature. Along with his co-founder, Joey, they went through hundreds of prototypes and then put the shoe up on Kickstarter in 2014. They reached their 120K goal in just 5 days. The company has now grown to more than 80 employees and recently landed $17.5 million in Series B funding, bringing their total to date to almost $30 million. Tim and I chat about his decision to use a no-branding strategy, something that's basically unheard of in the footwear industry, and the core values his team lives by that he says has been crucial to the brand's success. Without further ado, the entrepreneur behind the shoe that Time Magazine named the world's most comfortable shoe, Tim Brown.
I feel like Allbirds is like the rock star startup because everybody that I know has a pair. So there was a lot of people that were volunteering to do the podcast for me, and I feel like I've done a lot of them, but I feel like there's something about your brand that's especially magical. So I'm really excited to dig in and talk about it.
Oh, that's very kind of you to say. Thank you.
Absolutely. And with that being said, tell us, for people that don't know about Allbirds, and again, I'm not sure who those people would be because I feel like everyone I know knows about Allbirds. Tell us a little bit about the brand.
Yeah, sure. Allbirds was born really in New Zealand, where I'm from initially, a number of years ago. I was back there. I had a prior to founding the company, I had a professional sporting career. And I was back there and sponsored by one of the big sportswear companies, and everything I had logos all over it. And I think the initial insight that sort of led to, you know, the journey that would take kind of me and now my co-founder Joey to Allbirds was a design insight. And that was that there was this sort of big shift going on, Monica, in the way that people were working and the way that they were playing. And it felt like fashion had caught up with it. And there was this sort of understated, unbranded, casual, comfortable apparel options. And footwear had not seen that trend. And certainly in New Zealand, the only kind of footwear that you could buy that was unbranded and simple was sort of Chuck Taylors. And I really had the belief that I could make something better than that. So that's kind of really where it all started. And in the off season of my sporting, season, I found a shoe factory, started making shoes, and really had the second insight, which was that the footwear industry is just this very big old fashioned category that still uses manufacturing processes from 100 years ago. And they make things largely as cheap as they can. They make them for bottom dollar in Asia, and they make them out of synthetics and leathers that are really kind of not very nice for the environment, and saw an opportunity to potentially bring natural material innovation into footwear, footwear that would be better for that, i.e. more comfortable, and then also better for the environment. And that's really kind of the foundation. Those two are the two insights of the foundation of really what has become Allbirds.
And tell me a little bit more about the actual making of the footwear, because I think that, you know, obviously as founders, we talk to a lot of people that have innovative ideas. And, you know, as somebody that, you know, manufactures clothing, I've been surprised at how long the process is, how complex it is, the relationships with factories, sourcing the right materials. It's so much more complicated than I think sometimes people think when they first consider that they have an idea to make X. And I think that shoes must be exponentially more difficult than clothing. So what timing did that take to actually get your first, you know, from the time you had the idea for the shoe until you slipped one of them on your feet? How long was that?
Well, I told you this lovely little buttoned up story, and the process was something far different. I'm talking probably about a five year process. Making stuff, as you've touched on, and you're so right, is just incredibly hard. Making footwear, I think, is another level again. It's been described to us as an engineering project. There's obviously human factors, there's size and fit, there's the dynamics of different wear occasions, and all of that. We're trying to do that with a material that hadn't been used in footwear before. We were doing it with really zero experience, the complete naivety to believe that we could actually make a shoe in the first place. So it took a number of years. And I look back to when I sort of started that journey. If I knew what I know now, I probably would never have started, because just making things is just so hard.
It's so hard. You know, it's so funny you say that. My husband has a brand called Interior Define, and they do direct from manufacturing sofas. And no, he doesn't have, like, you know, until somebody orders it, it's customized for them. He doesn't have to buy any product. And I continually tell him how brilliant I feel like it is, because, you know, as somebody that also has to, like, make projections and, you know, figure out how much your consumer is going to buy. And obviously, Allbirds, you've done it incredibly well. That's one of the things we find most difficult about our business is, like, okay, we know what people are buying right now, but where are we going to be a year from now? And, you know, that, how does that process start? So for shoes, how long is the production time for that? Is that like a couple of weeks or a couple of months?
Oh, I mean, from development can be years. A year and a half probably is sort of a streamlined development process. In terms of the lead time for ordering, it can be months, particularly when you're using natural fibers that that are more complicated in their sort of production and preparation. So it's just a very, very, very difficult thing. I think one of the things that we've tried to do, and one of the advantages that we have, Monica, is that we only offer two products. So we've been able to build our business around a kind of another insight, which is the footwear industry is all about making more stuff. It's disposable in the way that it approaches things. I think every American buys something like 7 or 8 pairs of shoes a year, each on average. And so there's this sort of like cheap and nasty sort of method of production. And I think anyone who's sort of logged on Zappos has seen in the footwear category just thousands and thousands of choices. So part of our thinking was we would go in the opposite direction and we'd have a singular solution, and we'd focus deeply on one or two products initially and just make those as close to perfect as we possibly could. So we, I think, have some real advantages in the way that we've approached it from a supply chain and a making point of view. And I think we went through a couple of hundred different prototypes. We asked ourselves, you know, if you were going to make one sneaker, what would it look like? And it was going to be the most comfortable in the world, and it was going to be made out of wool, what would it look like? And that was a painful process, but I think it's been advantageous now as we sort of scale and grow the business that we've got such a reduced number of products.
I love that. And I think that's a key takeaway that that our listeners could really learn from as well, is that you definitely don't need to go to market with too much product. I think being very, very narrow and deep, as you're describing, is a great way to go. I remember when my brother first launched Bonobos, I think, honestly, I don't know how long it was, but I mean, they had 3 pairs of pants that they were selling out of the trunk of, you know, his car for a very long time. And even as we launched, we were a blanket brand at the very onset and had very few SKUs. But I do think it gives you an opportunity to know and understand your customer and really hone your product. I completely agree with the idea that less is more. That said, when you were doing fundraising, and I assume you did that from early days potentially, was that a tough sell to investors? Because at times I found it was when we were first starting.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's a great point. And I think just to wrap up your earlier observation, I think there's the sort of the misconception that innovation is about more and more and more and more features and more products. And sometimes innovation can actually be taking things away.
Yes.
It can be reducing stuff. And I think what we've done in the footwear space is, you know, the real point of difference is that we're whispering when everyone else is screaming. We've had the courage to have a singular solution. And I think you've seen it with other brands like Casper and you know, this courage to go into these crowded, confusing markets and offer a singular solution. And, you know, to your point, that's a great plan, assuming people like that product. And I think I think investors initially loved the idea. As we got nearer to launch, I think, and is always the case when you're about to throw something in the world, people started to get nervous. And they said, hey, this shoe that you're making is unremarkable. You can't go to market with just one. That's not how you play. You know, play by the rules. You've got to have a range. You've got to change it seasonally. And this insight that we had, this conviction that we had, got severely tested just prior to launch. And I think without really backing ourselves, I think Joey, my co-founder, and I most likely would have walked away from it and possibly lost some of the beauty and the magic of the business. So I think sometimes when you have an idea that's different, when you're truly innovating, at some point along the line, if it's not making someone uncomfortable, you haven't pushed it far enough.
Absolutely. And do you feel like in those early pitches that you did, I mean, I think one of the benefits is that, you know, the people that were investing could at least wear the shoes. So was part of it, like you had them try it and see how they liked it? Because you've developed such a cult following. I'm interested to understand how that type of cult following starts.
Well, I don't think you set out on to build a business with a cult following. And it's very nice of you to say. I don't think that we're sitting around in all birds offices thinking that we've made it. I think we've just been completely relentlessly focused on this product. And we've made, you know, 200 prototypes before we launched. And I went through a Kickstarter phase in the early days to prove out the idea. And then since we've launched the product, we've made, you know, basically something like 27 changes just based on customer feedback. And that's something we can talk about in more detail too. So I just think it's just been a relentless focus on the product. And I think people respect that when they feel a product that, you know, that where people have sweated over every detail and they wear or use a product that somehow improves their life, albeit in a small way. And so just never losing sight of that, I think is really, really important. I think one of the advantages we had when we fundraised is that, I'd done this Kickstarter campaign out of business school in the very early stages of this idea. So prior to raising money. So I think, I think we had some nicks and scratches and we had some mistakes and we had, albeit even at that time, a clear vision of what we wanted to do, but an imperfect product. But I think they really appreciated the fact that we weren't just coming to them with an idea, that we'd actually gone out into the world and tried to make it. And it's amazing how many people come and talk to us about, even now, and I'm sure the same to you, about different ideas for businesses. And you know, most of the time the best advice you can give them is just go start, just go try, go out to the world and try and make something. And you realize once you do that, I think it tests your conviction around the business. And I think we had the real advantage of having tried for quite a long time when we went to investors.
I think that's a really good takeaway, Tim, that people could grab from this, is that you're initially what you go out to market with. I mean, it's got to be the best that you can do, but it won't be perfect, because I agree, you'll learn so much about it. I mean, I even think back to some of what we initially went out with and, oh my gosh, we've learned and evolved and changed so much since those early days, but just getting out and doing it is so important, because you can't learn without having those first few customers or testing those first few pieces. When do you, and by the way, it always feels different on the inside of the brand than the outside of the brand. So from the outside looking in on Allbirds, I can definitely say, like, I mean, you guys have way reached a tipping point where, you know, I drop my daughter off at Shoes and, you know, there's Allbirds walking in and out the door. I come to the office, same thing. And you guys span generations. It's like, my mother-in-law has a pair. My husband has a pair. I definitely want to get a pair for my daughter, because I just learned about the small bird. So I will certainly be after those soon as well. But for you internally, when do you feel like you reach that tipping point?
I don't think you ever do. I just don't. It's just not the way that we think. And I don't know if it's kind of, something that's a carryover from my professional sporting career prior to this in a different life. But you can never be complacent. You can never think that it's finished. And I think, I'm sitting here today in the office here in San Francisco with 10 things front of mind that we could be doing better. And I think the reason that we've cared so much is the reason that we've been able to kind of cut through in a very, very crowded market. And I just don't think there's any substitute for that type of feeling. And I know it'll be the same for you and your business. And when is the right time? When is it finished? No, it's never finished. What I would say is in the early stages of building a business and of releasing a product, at some point someone pulls out their wallet and they take over their hard earned cash and they sort of sign effectively a contract with you and they take your product and everything changes at that moment. And the sooner you can get there or try and get there, I think is when you really learn, because the weight of that responsibility to return value and to make sure that they tell other people about that experience and the fact that they and the hope that they come back as a customer, I think is when the business stops being an idea and starts being real. And the sooner you can get to that moment and the gravity of that situation, the better you'll be. And then I think the real fun starts.
Absolutely. As somebody, and I'm looking at you guys have just, recently closed your Series B not that long ago. As somebody that feels like, you know, there's always fundraising on the horizon. And I'm sure that that's, you know, maybe that's not how you feel now, but in the earlier days, that's definitely how you feel. And as someone that's pre my Series B type of time frame, what was the Series B fundraise like for you?
You know, it was something that we didn't need to do. And I think one of the things that Joey and I had done from the very beginning is be incredibly careful with every dollar. And we still have these $23 fold out Costco tables in the office as a reminder of kind of where we've come from and tried to be incredibly careful, with the way that we've built the business. And I think, you know, not every business can do that, but I think that, you know, it's funny, even in the very first, seed round that we raised, led by Lera Hippau and then Navron, which is a Seattle based fund that led our A round. You know, that's not the time to celebrate. That's when the pressure starts.
Yes.
I think when you raise money. And so I think we've been fortunate. We've done it at the right time with great people. And certainly in the case of the B, it's not something that we needed to do, but we did it at a time and with someone that we felt could really help us sort of get to the next level in terms of what we were trying to build. But it's a difficult thing. But ideally, you know, the two things I'd say is put yourself in a situation where you don't need to do it, and you can do it on your terms, and just be stay out of that process as much as you can. I think we always thought like an hour having conversations with investors was really an hour that we're not building the business. So try and be extremely careful in how you sort of approach that whole process, because you can get sucked into it.
Oh my gosh. I couldn't agree more. And as someone that's recently been looking at speaking to investors myself, I think in the early days, you don't realize like you're so eager to bring in the capital to get the business going. And I was very fortunate. You know, I had the unfair advantage of like my brother being, you know, chairman of the board and giving me advice. And part of the reason why I wanted to do the podcast was I think the advice is so relevant for so many people. But taking money from the right people is so critical. And I've really realized that in recent days too, because when you've got the right people at the table, you know, you're able to make the right decisions for the right reasons. And sometimes bringing in the wrong people, which I've been fortunate as of yet not to do. And of course, I'll never say never. I don't know what the future holds. I've realized at this stage of the game, 3 years in, that makes you so much more powerful, because you know you have, you know, these evergreen people that you can count on should you need. They make the right introductions, like bring the right technologies to the table. It's so much more, I realize that so much more now than in the early days when I really didn't, you know, when the idea of like a $25,000 or a $50,000 check is so powerful, that it's hard to understand what that future relationship will be like with that individual. So for people that are listening, and it sounds like you've raised a considerable amount of capital, much better to do it when you don't need it, as you said, because then you can take it on your own terms.
Yeah. And I think you're exactly right in terms of the people. And I, you know, I think if there's one that we've just got, the phenomenal people are backing us. And I just think the one indicator that you should really, really, really pay attention to when you're meeting and speaking with investors is the types of questions they ask. It will be the strongest signal, I think, to what motivates them and what they're interested in terms of what they dig at and what they ask. It will be the most telling thing. And I'd look to that very, very closely. But sorry to cut you off.
No, I agree. I think the idea of vetting them as much as they vet you, because a lot of times I think as a new entrepreneur, you walk into these investor meetings, you know, eager to please, to get people to like you, to sell yourself. And I had come from, I had been in the pharmaceutical industry for 10 years previous. So much like you, I'd done something completely different. And so that my whole personality was about being able to do that, getting people to like that, to like me, wanting them to be able to talk to me. And I really had to, not only as a CEO of the company, but as a fundraising person, to actually shed that persona, because I realized, wow, it's just as important that I like you as that you like me, because it is a partnership. And it took me a long time to realize that. Luckily, not so long, you know, I didn't take in the capital until after I did. But I think that's very powerful for people, because you know, at the end of the day, you want them to say that they'll give you the money, but you also need to have the power to say, hey, this isn't the best fit for the company or for me personally. And I think that that's a good thing for people to understand if they haven't fundraised before.
Yeah. And look, the fundraising process is difficult and awful and not fun and frustrating. And you know, you should never take it for granted or take investment for granted that you receive. But all things being equal, I think it's about relationships and about people, and you know, find someone that shares the vision for what you want to do and what you want to be, and someone that's going to be honest with you. And I think you go a long way to helping yourself in that scenario. And I think we've just got some incredible people backing us at the moment.
Absolutely. Well, and I feel the same way. That's a good feeling to have. You mentioned Joey, your co-founder and co-CEO.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what that's like, having a co-CEO.
Yeah, it's probably one of the things I'm most proud of. And just sort of backing up, I mean, just sort of to finish the narrative. So I had this sort of early idea. I retired from my sporting career and I went off to business school in London. And I had an insight and a couple of insights and some prototypes. And I came out of business school and everyone told me that the idea of wool shoes was a really bad idea. But I had one particular professor who encouraged me to just launch it, to get the idea out of my system, because for some reason I seemed particularly enamored with it. And so he encouraged me to launch it on Kickstarter. And I did that in 2014 and it really blew up. And in 4 days, I think we sold $120,000 worth of shoes, and I had to turn it off because I wasn't at that stage quite sure how I was going to make them. And I really, you know, stumbled into really having that with no money raised. I had a year in London trying to get this thing off the ground, and I had a couple of young guys helping me, but no help, no capital. I was doing customer service. I was trying to deliver to multiple countries around the world. I was trying to work out how to make shoes. I was trying to use a new material. It was just an awful experience. And one of my first Kickstarter customers was Joey. Our wives are best friends. They went to college together on the East Coast, and he'd been an informal advisor as he watched me fumble through the early days of the business. And, you know, we'd known each other through weddings and different sort of get togethers through our wives. And I got to the end of that year and I actually had my first investment offer, and Joey took a look at the deal for me, and it was a horrible, horrible deal. And I was kind of quite honestly ready to just about walk away. And right at that moment, he'd been working in the biotech space here in the Bay Area. And, you know, we just decided, hey, look, this could be interesting. I could do all the things that I don't think that, you know, you can do, and maybe vice versa. And we decided to form a partnership and really haven't sort of looked back. And it's been a really remarkable thing, a challenging thing, but I'm just incredibly proud and lucky to have Joey as a co-founder.
That's so great. And you have a team. Your team is like over 50 people now.
Eight, 88 as of yesterday, I believe. Yeah.
Wow. Incredible. And you guys divide up and work in different areas in terms of like what you cover, or how do you like?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I kind of take care of product and brand, and Joey does, you know, technology and operations and finance. And then we meet in the middle over people, of human resources. And so we share that. And so there's a sort of natural split from our skill set. So, I went to business school, but I studied as a designer initially at the very beginning. So kind of the product and the brand was very much my sweet spot. And Joey is an engineer. He's a Wharton graduate. He'd been working in the biotech space. So has a deep empathy for sustainable materials and a strong conviction in the way that they should be used or could be used in consumer products. So it was kind of really the sort of meeting of two different skill sets. So the left and right brain maybe is oversimplifying it a little bit, but certainly, we have this complementary set of skills, and that's not to say that it's easy. I think we debate everything. We're across the aisle all the time, but with a deep respect for each other's sort of skill sets. And again, like I said, it's not always been easy, but it's one of the things I'm most proud about in terms of how we build Allbirds.
Absolutely. And do you feel like from the beginning, you know, you talk about obviously Allbirds is a product, it's a shoe, but there's so much purpose behind the brand. Was that purpose there like right as you started, Tim?
No, it's a great question. And so, you know, the first two insights were, you know, kind of, if we go back, it's sort of design and then natural materials. And then the third one, really, I credit completely with Joey. And I had a year of working out, you know, what the hell I was doing. I was making shoes. My dad used to call me a cobbler. I had no sort of particular real reason or sort of understanding as to why I was kind of embarking on this business journey. And I was able to connect the dots with Joey. And I think he came in, he'd been working for a biotech firm trying to sell an algae innovation into corporations and sort of struggling with that. So he saw a huge opportunity, I think, to go onto the brand side and actually build – sustainable materials into the product offering. And I think we had the kind of the shared belief that products shouldn't be made sustainably. You should make the best products and use sustainable materials to make a better experience. And we saw there was a huge opportunity in footwear, and we haven't really looked back. I think all the doubt of the early stages of the business was you know, certainly disappeared for me when Joey and I rallied around the idea that there was a real problem to solve here that was larger than just selling shoes. And we haven't looked back, and it's the core of the business. And I think our mission and the idea of making better shoes in a better way is sort of something that we've hung on to and have built a team around. So it's a very, very important part of the brand.
And your idea to not really have a branding strategy, like the idea that there's not logos, like, was that a difficult one to come by? Because it's exciting that you've created this brand, and you can, I mean, even my daughter recognizes brands, and Phil, one of my investors, and Howie here at the office, and Brian, everybody has Allbirds as to my husband. And she recognizes, you know, without any logo or anything, that it is like the same, oh, those are the same shoes that daddy has. So is it interesting that you don't have a logo and yet you've created this branding without branding?
Well, I think that's kind of where brand is heading at the moment. I mean, I think if you look back into sort of the 70s and the 80s and the emergence of sort of lifestyle brands like Ralph Polo, Tommy Hilfiger, maybe even Tory Burch a little bit later down the line, they were all characterized by these kind of fantasy lifestyles and big, large logos. And if you didn't get the point initially, the logos got larger. And then I think, you know, what we're seeing now is with the rise of, I think, social media and technology and the complete transparency that provides consumers into a brand, is that the story and the real purpose behind the business is something that you can't fake. It has to be real, and that becomes the brand. The brand becomes the story and the feeling and the materials and the purpose. And I think you're seeing, this kind of complete shift in the way that brands are presented, and they have to stand for something more. I think in our particular sort of category, I think there was this stylistic trend too that was sort of going towards sort of more informal workwear and style, and that played into the idea that that you didn't need marks and logos and swooshes all over your shoes. So I think there was a kind of a number of things going on, but I sort of firmly believe that, you know, the evolution of brand isn't about logo and mark. It's about story and feeling. And we've been able to try and capture that, I think, in our product and our story.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the same things that we found. Like, I initially started the brand because I thought, wow, there's got to be better children's clothing, you know, just as my daughter was born. And then it was interesting. It's like a lonely new stay-at-home mom right after I left my job. I was really missing the sense of community, and the brand ended up becoming so much more about building a community over time. But that wasn't something that came to me until after I started making the product. So I do agree, you don't have to have all the answers in the beginning, but eventually understanding who you are and what you stand for is critical, and being able to convey that to our customers. And to be honest, I'm not even sure if we do that successfully. You know, that's what we are aspiring to try to do every day. But, you know, it's good to know that other people have had similar journeys along the way. What do you feel is one of the biggest challenges you've had to overcome in building Allbirds?
Oh gosh, so many things. I mean, I think, you know, obviously, you know, the manufacturing piece is we've talked about that, and it's incredibly hard. I think it's kind of, it's a little bit like washing the dishes. I don't think you don't win with manufacturing, but you can certainly lose. And I that piece is kind of a non-negotiable. I think the idea of building a brand that is clear, I think the mistake I see often, and what we've tried to avoid, is this idea of a brand or a product that sort of markets 10 different features rather than focusing on the singular solution or the singular hook that consumers kind of understand. They tell this deep and sort of winding story of all the things they're doing, and people just are confused as to the real reason for why you would connect with the brand. So I think we've tried to keep that really, really simple. But I think fundamentally, the thing that makes or breaks, you know, a business and ultimately helps it scale is people. And, you know, we talked about investors. So there's people outside of your company, but then also within your company, from your relationship to your founders, to the very first people you recruit, to the culture that you build. And very quickly, if something is successful and starts to grow, then you have other people doing you know, living or trying to execute on this vision that you've started with. So I think one of the really smart things we did, and it was led by Joey, and full credit to him for this, was we defined our mission, we decoded our values, and we made sure that we with everything going on, the number one priority was the team and the culture and the people that we built. Because I think if you get that bit right, Monica, you go a long, long way to being successful. And so if there's one thing that I worry about, certainly it's making sure that we never lose sight of that and making sure that the group we have is incredibly motivated. And I think we've done a pretty good job of that so far.
And do you have any... do you have advice on, I know no one can tell you how to build the right culture. I agree. You have to understand your mission. You have to understand your values. And as you're meeting and interviewing and talking to people, I do think keeping that top of mind, because a lot of times you meet the perfect person for the job, but they're not the perfect person for the company. And as somebody that's like hired the right people and the wrong people, and the wrong people are usually really good people too. It's always painful when the fit isn't there just because of that culture. Is there anything specific that you feel really sets your corporate culture apart, or something that, you know, other founders can learn from?
Yeah, I just think from the very beginning, it's funny. It's like all the qualities that that are fantastic for an entrepreneur to start something when the odds are against them, when everyone says it's a horrible idea, this ability to kind of just barrel forward despite, you know, the sense that, you know, maybe this was the odds of success are so small. But become, you know, your Achilles heel as you actually start to have people join you, because you feel like maybe you have all the answers. And I think you've got to be really, really careful to make sure that you do the things you do really well and be really honest about where you have holes and where you have gaps. And I think from the very beginning, we tried to, Joey and I, hire and attract people that do all the things that we don't do very well. And we hired just an incredible head of brand marketing who was our first hire. Neither of us had marketed or built a brand before. And so she came from Levi's and Nest from Google. And you know, same with operations, same with e-commerce. We got an amazing guy to lead e-commerce out of Zappos and finance. And it's sort of like we learn from those people, and you have this culture that you're trying to create where it's not one person making a decision, but it's the best idea. And I think, you know, Joey and I will be the first to admit we don't know what we're doing. And and I think that cultivates an environment of debate. And it's funny when candidates come to join us and they ask, oh gosh, you know, this co-CEO thing, who actually ultimately makes the decision? It's the wrong question, because the best idea ultimately wins, and that comes from everywhere, and that's the culture we've tried to build. And it's messier, but ultimately I think better. And I think that ability to sort of be really, really honest with yourself about the things you do well and get help where you have holes is I think a really important thing.
I agree. I think the best qualities in that I find in other CEOs that I meet, like yourself, are, you know, the people that think that other people do things better than them. I do think that's one of the keys, because at the beginning you are doing everything, but if you're doing your job, along the way you're hiring people that are way better at you than to do it. And one of the threads that I've found, and I'm curious as to if you see this too, and our company is like still small early days. I mean, we have a significant amount of employees at this stage only because we've expanded so much from a retail standpoint. So it seems bigger than it is. Like the core team is still small. But I think everyone that we bring on has a real entrepreneurial spirit and is sort of ready and willing to take on whatever comes their way. Because as I interview people and they're, you know, they want to know like exactly what the job's going to entail and exactly what the day-to-day is going to be. It's hard because at this stage of the game, I don't know. Like a lot of these jobs are still creating themselves. The person that's coming on is creating them. And so for me, the people that have been the most successful are the ones that, you know, do first and worry later, sort of, so that, you know, there's not so many questions before they get going. Because I find that I don't have any of the answers a lot of the times.
Yeah, I mean, you're so right. I think if there's one indicator of sort of success when you're bringing people on, is sort of scale fit, is probably a little bit of a funny term for it. But I think a lot of people say they want a startup experience, and then they're sitting on a $22 fold-out table and they don't have any of the resources that they've had in a much larger organization.
Yes.
And they really don't like it. And so I think, you know, really sort of pushing on that one is something that I think we've learned probably the hard way in a few cases, because I think we've had just some incredible candidates who think they want to come here and be in this sort of whirlwind of building a business, and then it's just not right for them, and they need more structure than we're able to provide, and they need more answers, and they need more resources even. And so I think it's unpackaging that. I think, you know, what I'm trying to look for when I'm hiring is, hey, we've got an opportunity here that is, you know, pretty cool. And you know, where are you at in your career, and what's the opportunity you're looking for, and do those two things sort of line up? And then I think, you know, there's qualities like grit and curiosity and all those types of things that I think are super important, because, you know, to your point, like, your business is different from week to week. So you need to be able to adapt and move and change and keep a smile on your face, really importantly, when things just don't go well. So yeah, it's not an easy thing, and the startup sort of world is not for everyone.
No, for sure. And I feel like in the early days, I tried to sell people on the job, and now I try to almost sell people out of the job. And if they're still interested in taking it after hearing, you know, the downsides, then usually that means that they're the right person, because I found that, like, I almost overconvince people to come on board in the beginning. And that's not always smart, because I have so little, not as much control over how things happen as I'd like to. And I think that's just the nature of the company. So I've hopefully gotten better in terms of my transparency with new people as they come on board. One last question for you, Tim, because I honestly could talk to you all day. I feel like there's so much that I could learn from you. I know you have a store in San Francisco and one in Soho. What are future plans for retail for Allbirds? Like, we've been experimenting a lot from a retail standpoint, but I'm curious as to what you're seeing.
Yeah, look, a huge part of our plans. I think we're really excited. We moved into a building in October last year, and it had a retail kind of space right below it. So we got thrown into it far faster than we ever thought we would. And what we have is, you know, I think we really like to think of it as our competitive advantage as a business, that we pointed the whole business around this direct-to-consumer channel to listen to our customers. And so we have everyone in the team spend time in retail. I've actually got a retail session this afternoon in the holiday rush. Everyone in the team goes down and spends time there. And I think, you know, what you get caught in the cloud sometimes when you're building a business, certainly as it scales. And the idea that, you know, we're upstairs sort of working on the larger strategy and the mission and all this sort of lofty stuff, and then you go down and actually fit someone in your product and put a pair of shoes on someone, and it's incredibly sort of humbling and grounding, I think, to just remember what this whole thing's about. I think in terms of the actual channel, I think we've seen incredible success in that first store, and that led to a second store quite quickly in Soho that's gone even better and is amazing. And we're trying to now work out, you know, how we not only just do retail, but do retail really well. And that's, you know, it's something that we're investing a lot of time in and thinking about. But I think 2018 will be, you know, a couple more stores, almost certainly. And we're just incredibly bullish about it. And I think it's obviously a standalone kind of formal contribution to your business, but it's also it's an acquisition channel. It's a brand experience. I think people want to touch and try on shoes, certainly, but all physical products. So I think the idea that retail is dead is wrong. I just think bad retail is dead, and people want an experience. And it's an enormous part of, I think, you know, building a great direct-to-consumer brand.
I couldn't agree with you more. We actually launched retail and online simultaneously because my brother had said to me, hey, Monica, if I did this again, you know, I would have my Bonobos office in the back of a guide shop, and you know, we would do it at the same time. And that's actually what we did. Now, what I didn't know when we did that is that retail would be so all-encompassing for that first year, because it was such a powerful medium that it actually took us much longer to get the online portion of it going because we sold everything we had in person. So I am, and I did have my office in the back of our guide shop in Lincoln Park in Chicago for almost 2 years. So I understand, awesome, like, meeting the customer. So retail has been very powerful for us. And I believe too, that companies that have retail as a component over time will need to raise less capital because the halo effect, the residual marketing, the customer experiencing the brand, it just moves you along the continuum faster. So I kind of did it the opposite way that maybe I should have. It took me longer to build a digital strategy and, like, understand my online customer and how to get to them. But physical retail is fun. And I love the idea that your team goes and works in your stores. And I can't wait. I actually have not gone to one yet. So next time I'm in New York or San Francisco, I am absolutely coming by. I can't wait to experience the brand in person.
Yeah. Well, it's not going to be right for everyone, and every strategy is going to be different. But I love that story that your offices were in the back. I mean, it's about, you know, really the direct to consumer channel is, you know, it's been talked about as a disruptive thing, and it's about margins and delivery. But really for me, it's about the feedback loop. And I just think retail is such a big part of it. So, you know, we're weighing up a color or a new product introduction, you know, and our head of design just goes down and sort of throws it out in the store and sees what, and sort of gets feedback and straight away. It's all about feedback. And that's really what I think about when I think about that channel, and I think about the way that we've sort of designed the business. And it's also, you know, you can acquire a customer through, you know, an ad or an out of home campaign. You can also acquire them through a great retail experience. So it's rethinking exactly kind of what retail is, I think, is really important. And that's not a new insight. It's not unique to Allbirds, but it's certainly, I think, a huge opportunity and that people really should consider really early on.
I agree. And you know what's interesting? We've had like the Lincoln Park location we've had for 3 years. I am astounded by the continued growth and the return customers. That's what really drives it too. Like, we've always got new people discovering us, but the loyalty of the people that keep coming back is really fun. And hopefully we just did 6 pop-up locations in 7 weeks.
Wow.
Was really crazy, Tim. I would definitely not recommend going that quickly. Oh, it went well, but I feel like it was a huge strain on such a small team. I was so impressed with, you know, what our tiny little team did in a short time. But it would be fun to have a whole nother discussion about retail. And we're actually now in Walnut Creek in San Francisco. So, or outside of San Francisco, Broadway Plaza. So at some point, maybe you can bring your daughter to visit us there.
Oh, that'd be great. It'd be so good. Yeah. I just think, you know, it's funny. You start to sort of, you build a business that has a digital experience, and then you try and translate that into a physical environment. And it's just so hard. It just takes time. Like, we've worked out that our packaging that we initially designed for online works wonderfully well, but then, you know, doesn't work so well in retail. So we're going to kind of overhaul that, you know. So it's just all the little things, it just takes a lot of time. But I, you know, I think the opportunity is enormous, and yeah, it's great to hear that you see that as well.
Yeah, no, it's been really fun. And Tim, thank you so much. It was so fun talking to you. I really appreciate you joining me, and congratulations on all of your continued success. And I look forward to meeting in person at some point.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you so much for your time. Really enjoyed the chat.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Tim.
Hope you enjoyed the episode. For more information and tips from our guests, stop by monicaandandy.com or check us out on Instagram at monicaandandy. If there's someone you want to hear from or have any other suggestions, please leave us a comment on iTunes. Thank you for listening.